This solidity really serves us well in times when the winds come up. The Sangha is invited to go back to her breathing, so our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as a single organism. Going like a river, there is no more separation. Let the Sangha breathe like one body. Chant like one body. Listen as one body. And transcend the frontiers of a delusive self, transcending the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex. So please take care of your bodies. Maybe do some stretching up to the sky. Feel your feet. Nancy likes to say walking on clouds. Maybe get some little hydration if you need it. I find meditation to be thirsty work. So, dear friends, many of us have been on a journey together for the past 2 years, exploring the Bodhisattva's question, how can I help? And practicing to embody Maitreya, the Buddha to be born, the community of awakened beings. I'd like to do a little review just so we remember all that we've been through together. And if you haven't been here the whole time, you can have a quick course on it. So in 2023, we were introduced to Bodhisattvas who helped us craft a life of love and purpose. We started with Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of great understanding, of wisdom. And then we made friends with Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of great compassion. And then Sattaparibhuta, the never disparaging Bodhisattva, who only sees the true goodness in each being. We met Wonderful Sound, who brings us the universal language of music from the cosmos. And we met Earth Store Bodhisattva, who teaches us how to cherish and protect our mother and father, earth and sky. Then in 2024, we turned our attention to Maitreya, the next embodiment of the Buddha after Shakyamuni, who our teacher Thay said would be not an individual, but a community. We are learning and training to be part of that community, that Maha Sangha, that will turn the wheel of our world from separation and suffering to peace and connection. It's crucial to remember that to do this work, we need challenges. We need difficulty so we can exercise our muscles of compassion and wisdom. And for me, at least in the midst of this work, we've found a lot of joy in being together and in revealing ourselves through our friendship and through silence. In 2024, we began to incorporate practices that apply these insights and help us move towards daily embodiment. Thay gave us so many practical ways to become awakened in the midst of our lives. In his talk in September, Tim Motley called these practices touch points. And then Sandy, leading a peaceful refuge session, referred to them as touchstones. I love this so much, so I found a small round stone to carry with me to remind me to come home to the moment, anchoring me in reality, encouraging me not to try to escape whatever I might be facing. This is a practice you might want to try. Find a stone or a shell that speaks to you, some small token of the natural world, and carry it with you. Let it comfort and ground you, especially when challenges come. So let's stop for a moment and enjoy a short meditation. This one is adapted from a book called Original Love by Dharma teacher Henry Shukman. For me, doing this reminds me that at any moment I can drop right into what's most important. Our muscle of equanimity allows us to let go and be with what's most important. And this in turn defines how we show up. He calls this the vast peace meditation. So just settle down again and connect with your breathing. Imagine that right now, the presence of something great and peaceful is with you. Imagine that you can sense a great peace all around you. Imagine that just beneath, just behind everything you are experiencing, there is a vast silence, which has a kind of immaculate, gentle power. Imagine this power to be an immensely peaceful force that is holding your experience of this moment, holding everyone and everything in this place. Let yourself be held by this greater unseen presence. Feel its goodwill toward you. Imagine or feel this silence, this peace, as love holding you in this moment. Sense that somehow you know this deep, mysterious love as an essential ingredient of this world. So let's review some of the practices offered in the past year and see which ones helped you and which ones you still might want to explore further. Which ones are a part of you now, have become you, are part of your lovely expression of life. So in 2023, we began our Bodhisattva training with the question, how can I help? Teacher Judith Leaf says, Bodhisattvas are the ones who see the depth and breadth of suffering and confusion most clearly, yet they place themselves right in the midst of it. They have learned that no matter how bad things become, it is possible to change the spot. The flow of compassion cannot be interrupted. In fact, with each new crisis, its flow is increased. So as aspiring bodhisattvas, we train with the four great bodhisattva vows. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The awakened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. These vows remind us that we are not here to solve a problem, to right a wrong, or to perfect ourselves and our world. We are here to sit in the middle of the mess, embodying the compassionate equanimity of the universe, to be shining jewels of love, open to helping in any way that presents itself. On my healing journey of the past year, I keep getting seduced by feeling pain-free and starting to make plans for the future, only to have my pain friend return and upend whatever assumptions I've been making. Returning to the moment, showing up with loving care for myself, pain is teaching me that I am not a fixed entity, that I am a swirl of constantly moving energy, that I might as well let go of expectations. When awareness is present that all life is a continuous flow of change, the pain arrives in its infinite variety of flavors, just as a flower never seen before blooms in front of me and within me. Can the same curiosity to know this new friend arrive for the pain as well as for the beauty? Can the wonder of all life encompass each arriving experience, releasing any conception of pleasant or unpleasant? Can my love for this life show up to be the best, most intimate friend with whatever's going on within me and around me? Can the experience of me be the constant changing colors of sensation and form? Can I know all of it as love? Pir Vilayat Khan tells us, overcome any bitterness that may have come because you were not up to the magnitude of the pain entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, you are sharing in a certain measure of that cosmic pain and are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. So let's remind ourselves of the gifts from the bodhisattvas that we got to know in 2023. As we know, we started with Manjushri. Manjushri is the holder of right view, which forms our whole experience of life. He carries a sword in one hand that he uses to cut through delusion, and the lotus of prajna, wisdom, in the other. There's so much confusion and delusion in our society right now. We need Manjushri's sword more than ever. We practice with Manjushri by asking ourselves, how can I cut through my confusion? How can I bring clarity to my relationships? What ideas and views can I let go of so I can understand and love more fully? We can use these tools. The first one is don't know mind. We are wise when we know that we don't know, that our views are incorrect only, simply because they're limited. and we learn to not make assumptions. We can also use the mantra, "Are you sure?" That becomes a part of our continual interaction with life. In a teaching on signlessness, Sister True Dedication says, "We're invited to challenge the idea that what we cherish always needs to take a certain form or appearance, a sign. We may think that progress needs to look a certain way, but perhaps the way forward is through the dark. We may think an enlightened, compassionate, and just society must check certain boxes, but perhaps there's still suffering we need to understand deeply before that collective awakening can fully ripen. There can be hollow victories that exclude too many people, as well as powerful losses that can lead to wider, more inclusive moments. Perhaps what we love and cherish is still there, still growing and ripening in its own time. Are we sure that all is lost?" And we can also use the mantra, "You are partly right," reminding ourselves that we all hold a piece of the truth, but not all of it. And we are all made of basic goodness. The next bodhisattva we became friends with is Avalokiteshvara. While Manjushri represents wisdom, Avalokita represents compassion. The bird of awakening needs both wings, the wings of wisdom and compassion, in order to fly. When love meets suffering, it becomes compassion. And then our question naturally arises, how can I help? When you are able to skillfully open your heart this way, creative solutions and possibilities for living differently appear. Avalokiteshvara's superpower is listening, not turning away from suffering, but leaning into it, opening our hearts. There are so many parts of life where deep suffering is continuous and excruciating. We need to know our capacities for being present with each, and to know when we need to retreat to protect ourselves from being overwhelmed. Our practice is to settle our body and mind, to simply rest in the reality of the moment. In this way, we enable our hearts to listen both to ourselves and to others. We can offer that stillness, that openness. That is compassionate listening. We show up fully, trusting that being present to life is the healing. In this way, we let go of needing or wanting things to be different than they are in this moment. Compassionate listening requires letting go. We practice compassionate listening to monitor the opening of our heart. We also met Bodhisattva Wonderful Sound, whose liberating music can go right to the heart of the person who hears it and transform their mind and heart. This cosmic music is a universal language we can all comprehend, not through our mental faculties, but through our hearts, our bodhicitta. The next bodhisattva we met is Sadaparibhuta, never disparaging bodhisattva, who takes us into the dimension of action. Sadaparibhuta sees only the bodhicitta, the true goodness in each person. To develop this skill, we have the practice of flower watering, calling out the beneficial qualities of every person you meet. We can also develop our ability to experience wonder and awe. We practice positive psychology. We learn to change the story when it doesn't reveal the beauty and miracles inherent in life each moment. Sadaparibhuta teaches us to challenge the stories we believe about ourselves and others. When we hold a view about ourselves or someone else, we learn to ask, what if this story isn't true? What if it is only one part of the story, and I'm missing other layers of it. Does my story include bodhicitta, the understanding and calling out of everyone's seed of universal goodness? We aspire to be the mirror reflecting the true goodness of everyone we meet. Now we come to our friend Earth's Store Bodhisattva, Dharanamdara. He is teaching us how to reconnect with our mother, to fall in love with her again. His skills are confidence, solidity, steadiness, strength, and equanimity. Thay said, "When you wake up and see that the earth is not just the environment, the earth is in you, you are the earth, and you touch the nature of interbeing, at that moment you can have real communication with the earth. That is the highest form of prayer." In 2024, our attention turned to exploring the nature of Maitreya, the Buddha to be born, the Buddha of love. All the bodhisattvas we have become friends with have special qualities that teach us how to love more deeply and more potently. They are a kind of wisdom council, sitting with us as we continue our exploration of how to awaken and serve the world. So we began to step up and apply these tools of love each day. Many of us started the year cultivating a Kalyanamita, or spiritual friend, through the buddy system. Having a spiritual friend to share with is priceless, offering comfort and support and inspiration. I'm just going to list some of the other tools we practiced with just to remind you of how much we've done and how rich our toolbox is. We practice with awareness of our life force, of not squandering it, but using it wisely in the service of our bodhisattva ideals. We practiced with intention setting, learning where, how and where to direct our energy. We practice stopping, including conscious breathing, every 15 minutes. We practice with mindful food preparation and mindful eating. We practice with gathas, grateful acknowledgments. We developed our warm-heartedness through smiling practice. We practice having a conscious focus on nourishing joy and happiness, which helps us not be overwhelmed by suffering. And in this way, we learn to turn towards suffering as the path to joy, realizing that suffering and happiness are not separate, that embracing the challenges are the very aspiration of the bodhisattva. We use the mantra of "this too" when something comes that we find hard to welcome. We open with our spaciousness, "this too." And we practice with "just like me" when needing to open ourselves to a different other, realizing our similarities. We practice learning to be the one who needs help as well as the helper. And we practice letting go, the joy of an open hand, the practice of surrender, of resting happily in the present moment. In July, we explored the big picture, our part in the evolution of consciousness. We practice seeing our life as an evolutionary experiment, and that as the embodiment of Maitreya, our assignment is to show the world that love is real. That no matter what happens, there will never be any less love. The nature of life is love, and we can touch it at any time without reservation. When we touch it, when we become it, we affect the collective consciousness. This is why we practice. So we have a toolbox stuffed with multi-use tools. It's one of those boxes that when you open it, multiple shelves come out filled with treasures. Each shelf contains so many ways to transform our limited view of life. And we need to use them. We need to take them out and let them work on our consciousness. Anytime you want a review or a reminder of how to apply these practices, you can go to the audio recordings at peacefulrefuge.org. Thank you, Dennis. So let's take a moment to reflect on the richness and abundance of the teachings we've received from our ancestors. Earlier in my life, I wondered why there wasn't an instruction manual that came with being born, helping me create a life of good choices so I could find my way wisely. I consider myself fortunate beyond measure that I found that instruction book in the Dharma, exploring and explaining the big questions and offering step-by-step methods for awakening to my true self. We need to step up to the reality that we are the continuation of all this wisdom and compassion, that right now we are the ones with the bodies, so we have the opportunity and the obligation to embody the Dharma, to keep the wheel of the Dharma turning. At the Democratic National Convention, Senator Cory Booker said, "We are our ancestors' wildest dreams." We need to own this. We need to step up, and this is what we're doing as we study and practice living an awakened life. This is the time of year when cultures and religions all over the world offer gratitude and respect to our ancestors. After the harvest, the quiet creates a time when those who have died and who are imprinted in our hearts can offer and receive communication. The more we realize that we are our ancestors in body form right now, we can access their wisdom and their skillful ways of responding. Plum Village has a practice called the Five Awarenesses, verses that we repeat regularly to remind us of the precious resource and commitment we have to take our place in the flow of life. Let's settle ourselves as we listen to the Five Awarenesses. We are aware that all generations of our ancestors, including our spiritual ancestors and all future generations, are present in us. We are aware of the expectations that our ancestors, including our spiritual ancestors, our children and their children, have of us. We are aware that our joy, peace, freedom, and harmony are the joy, peace, freedom, and harmony of our ancestors, including our spiritual ancestors, our children, and their children. We are aware that understanding is the very foundation of love. We are aware that blaming and arguing can never help us and only create a wider gap between us, that only understanding, trust, and love can help us change and grow. Our ancestors are the ground beneath our feet, literally and metaphorically. The more aware we are of this reality, the more grounded we feel. As we experience our roots going deep and wide, we are held in their wisdom and compassion. We remember that it's our turn to create ways to heal and transform our broken world. Our Plum Village tradition has also given us the healing practices of touching the earth. These meditations work away at our notion of isolation and separateness and help us experience our place in the web of life. We bring to mind ancestors throughout time and space and pray to be a worthy embodiment. Texts for several versions of touching the earth practice can be found in the Plum Village chanting book or at plumvillage.org. When I spend time remembering the lives of my ancestors, my parents, grandparents, and beyond, and also our land and spiritual ancestors, a deep well of respect and gratitude arises in me, as well as humility. The challenges they faced and the ways their lives were shaped through all of it shows each life to be its own unique and precious jewel. And I am about a bit shocked at all I don't know and will never know about their lives and what they faced and what they accomplished. I continue to ask for their help, not knowing what might come, realizing how much of my life I spent unaware of this precious resource. And even though most of it is a mystery, dark and unknown, can I be okay with the unknowing? Can I still draw on the resources being offered with open hands from beyond? Can I take my place as the embodiment of life? Communing with our ancestors, known and unknown, is a form of prayer. As we ask, how can I help? We also need to cultivate asking for help as a kind of prayer. The field of epigenetics recognizes that we inherit patterns, proclivities, and talents from our ancestors, and we pass them on to our descendants. When we contemplate this, we realize that everything we do to use our energy for the good, true, and beautiful helps future generations. I inherited many skills and abilities from my ancestors, and also some challenging, unbeneficial tendencies. I see it as my work to help transform these unskillful qualities. It's like a relay, and I've been handed the baton for this small portion of time. I have the body right now, so it's my chance to make an impact, which will turn this poor world a bit more in the direction of peace, harmony, and liberation. Thich Nhat Hanh tells the story of his realization after his mother died. I opened the door and went outside. The entire hillside was bathed in moonlight. Walking slowly in that soft light through the rows of tea plants, I observed that my mother was indeed still with me. My mother was the moonlight caressing me, as she had done so often, very gentle, very sweet. Every time my feet touched the earth, I knew my mother was there with me. I knew this body was not mine alone, but a living continuation of my mother and father, my grandparents and great-grandparents, and all of my ancestors. These feet I saw as my feet were actually our feet. Together, my mother and I were leaving footprints in the damp soil. From that moment on, the idea that I had lost my mother no longer existed. All I had to do was look at the palm of my hand or feel the breeze on my face or the earth under my feet to remember that my mother is always with me, available at any time. When you lose a loved one, you suffer. But if you know how to look deeply, you have a chance to realize that his or her nature is truly the nature of no birth and no death. Earlier this year, we talked about the importance of stories and how the stories that we believe and tell about our lives shape us and reflect back both our dilemmas and our wisdom. When we spend time contemplating our lives, we can learn valuable lessons about how our path brought us here, how the choices we made and the circumstances of our lives brought us an array of gifts and challenges. We might have an increased compassion for our dear younger selves who didn't know what was coming but bravely did their best. No matter what came and what choices we made, how fortunate each of us is because we all ended up here at the foot of the Bodhi tree, waking up to what's most important. Recently, I've been going through some files of the teachings I've offered over the past 15 years, and I have a bit of wisdom I wish I could impart to my younger self. Please date each teaching. I might have written 1119, but not the year. It probably seemed so obvious at the time, but I certainly wasn't holding the long view. Our teacher, Tai, would always begin a Dharma talk with stating the full date and location, both grounding us in the present and helping the archivist down the line. Tai was wise beyond words in so many ways. So we treasure our stories, gaining insight and equanimity from our life review. Years ago, in a class, we spent time doing a life review. This is a contemplative process where you allow memories and stories from your life to come into awareness while you maintain the spaciousness of an open heart. In this way, you learn to honor what happened, be it painful or joyful. You open to the possibility that everyone involved was doing their best in that moment. You realize that conditions of life come up beyond your ability to choose, but that you can choose how to respond. And in this moment, you can change your response to a memory. If it was painful at that time, you can see from a more spacious view the tenderness holding that moment, and perhaps the gifts the situation offered in helping to develop a strong and resilient heart. After we've honored the story of our lives, we become more able to let those stories go, to understand that they are a treasure map to guide us until we arrive. Then we put the map down and enjoy being at our destination, the present moment. We let go of all constructed reality and rest in the unconditioned. Roshi Joan Halifax says, "Our story is an artifact of our view." So when we change our view, our story changes. This is why we began these teachings with learning how to develop right view, clear seeing from our friend Manjushri. We learned that we need to ask ourselves, are we sure? What is really true in this moment? Perhaps our greatest challenge right now is to let go of what we think we know and open our story so we can move from paralysis to transformation. Instead of falling into a hole of regret about what we haven't been able to accomplish, we need to use that awareness to understand that this is a part of the hero's journey. When everything seems to be lost, that is where the path starts. Wendell Berry says, "It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work, and that when we no longer know which way to go, we have begun our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings." So as we open to not knowing, let's set our deepest prayers and intentions and fuel them with our energy of loving mindfulness and great imagination. We find ways to deepen our love for our home and to experience our Mother Earth loving us. We let our actions come from love, openness, and tranquility. We hold the promise of a healing world and do all we can to be part of the flowering. To me, there are only three prayers that I need. How can I help? I need help. And thank you. One thing we learn when we take up the way of the Dharma is the secret of the two truths, the relative and the absolute, the historical and the ultimate. We live always in both dimensions at once, and we can touch and embody each one simultaneously. From observing our stream of ancestors, we know we need a body to continue this work in the relative historical dimension. This is why our life force is so precious. We only have this time when we are breathing to step up. And perhaps the biggest mistake we make is when we think we only have this dimension and we forget our true nature, which is beyond any story, any notion of good or bad, birth or death, any duality. When we forget this and our historical story isn't going the way we want, we may fall into despair. This is the time we need to step back. We need to let go of all the stories and learn to surrender. The Bodhisattva's actions come from the historical dimension ruled by duality, as this is where the work takes place. But the intention for the action comes from the ultimate dimension. I'm going to share with you a list I made that helps me understand how the ultimate shines through our everyday reality. The historical quality is one to be developed, and it comes from the ultimate, which is always already present. For example, the historical quality of kindness is an expression of the ultimate quality of goodness. The historical quality of patience is an expression of the ultimate quality of stopping. The historical quality of forgiveness is an expression of the ultimate quality of surrender. The historical quality of hope is an expression of bodhicitta, the mind of love. The quality of prayer is an expression of the ultimate quality of silence. The quality of stories is the expression of the ultimate quality of storylessness. The quality of helping and asking for help is a quality of the ultimate quality of resting in the perfection of the moment. You might want to see your own intentions and actions through this lens as an exercise. Learning to weave your awareness of the ultimate into each daily action. Noticing how your response to each situation is born in the reality that all is perfect, all is love at the source. To me, it's imperative, especially at this time, that all our thoughts, words, and actions come from the embodiment of our true nature. Dharma teacher Henry Shukman explains our experience of the two truths. He says, it's possible to recognize at any time that in the heart of each moment, somehow, against all the odds, there is an infinite goodness. Each moment of life is a kind of goodness incarnate, no matter how hard life may be or how far from goodness it may seem. In evolutionary terms of development, we started life with a survival instinct, and then at some point we became aware of a mental self. So these two impulses then merged and became our ego. And then at some point, this became a pathological concept expressed as an unnecessary need to defend itself. Letting go of our story is discovering our self has no limits. We need to give up everything to become everything. Dharma teacher Joan Sutherland says, we're aware of how everything interpermeates everything else, and that even the most difficult things are lit from within by the same undivided light. Talking about awakened life in terms of not only enlightenment, but also endarkenment, she says, the enlightening aspect of compassion includes our shining commitment to everyone's freedom from suffering. The endarkening aspect of compassion is our willingness to have our hearts broken by the world so our hearts remain open and not defensive. As we endarken, we see that we are not only continuous with the luminous nature of the universe, but also continuous with the great broken heart of the world. We and the world share a tenderness that is both poignant beauty and wound. I'd like to share from Henry Shukman's book I've been talking about called Original Love, and he describes the path of our practice using the element of water. He says, the same way this world is wrapped and threaded through with water systems, so our life is threaded through with the water system of original love. Just as streams and small rivers nourish the high valleys, and puddles moisten the fields and ponds grace the woodlands, so in practice we first open up to mindfulness, to the capacity to be still in the midst of restlessness, to sit attentively and kindly with our unease, anxieties, and discomfort. We become kinder toward ourselves. Then we open up our sense gates to the world and start to notice its gifts of beauty, its need for help. This starts to open more secret sluices of love, like tapping into unknown water sources. Trickles of loving support start to seep into our life. As practice develops, we taste deeper stirrings of well-being. We catch glimpses of a river of practice, a force for good in the world, a wholesomeness different from the kinds of success we might previously have sought. We are being carried by a prior current of love, as if life has an intrinsic wholeness that makes it an act of love itself. This is the flavor of a mutual support we can trust. The river emerges into a broad lake. We float, entranced by the deep stillness of samadhi, of absorption, the wondrous awareness with which we are pre-installed, rich with the intrinsic well-being of existence, which does not need to be earned or won. Then, in time, we catch a glimpse of the great ocean. All of a sudden, it becomes clear that we aren't what we thought. Rather than being isolated and alone, we fall back into a wholesomeness that has always been here. We are that ocean. It formed itself into a shape, the little stream of our life. But now that stream knows it is inseparable from all water. We were never apart from the ocean. The clouds, the rains, the springs and aquifers, the storms and water tables, the brooks and torrents, the ponds and lakes, they are all one water system. Every part of this life is fully irrigated, fully alive with the loving energy of the ocean. Nothing is apart from the ocean. The water reaches everywhere. So let's do a guided meditation on letting go. This is adapted from one in Shukman's book. It's called Dissolving. It's a method of learning to let go of the self we think we are. So take a few conscious breaths. And become aware that you are aware. Now imagine a ceramic cup filled with water floating in a calm ocean. Let the water in the cup float in the midst of the wide waters of the ocean, all around it. Imagine that you are the awareness within the cup, and all around you is a greater awareness. Let your awareness fill your body. Let the wider awareness occupy the whole world around you. Now imagine that the cup is losing its opacity. It's fading into glass. Now there's the water within the glass and the water all around the glass. We can still distinguish between the two bodies of water, the small defined volume within the glass and the vast one all around. But the membrane separating the two has become transparent. Gradually allow that transparent membrane to release itself and dissolve. Let it disappear altogether. Allow yourself to surrender your sense of self. Let any boundary between you and all that surrounds you disappear. Let your sense of self disappear into the great ocean of awareness. Let your identity switch off. We no longer feel that we are a particular person. We belong to a vast awareness, and it seems to pervade all creation. We become all of creation. We are washed clean, and our experience of life becomes more transparent, just beyond the world of things, just behind it. We sense a great openness patiently waiting. Wave by wave, the great original love of the universe breaks over us and swallows more and more of us. Our part, our mindfulness, is to remember that we don't have all the answers, that we know so little, that our life is just a matchstick tossed on the waters, and that our role is to be humble enough to let that little matchstick allow in more moisture from the surrounding waters. We have to open the pores, allow the water in, and gradually, bit by bit, we become a little more waterlogged, which eventually allows us to break the surface tension of the body of water. Our holding together of the world as we know it starts to release, and we open to a great relaxing, a not knowing. We surrender. In early November, shortly before the election, Democratic Representative Jamie Raskin was asked in an interview, "If Trump is elected, what will you do the next morning?" And without a pause, Raskin responded, "Get up and go to work." So we dissolve, we let go of all resistance to what is, and then we get up and go to work. We embody both our historical and our ultimate natures with each intention, with each breath. When I was in my early 30s, a friend of a friend offered to do a psychic reading of some sort for me. I don't even remember this guy's name and never knew much about him. But I do remember one thing he told me. He said that the purpose of my life was to make spiritual the mundane. When I heard that, I thought, yuck, how boring. And I didn't think much about it for a long time. Only after several years of practicing mindfulness did I realize that this is a wonderful definition of mindfulness, making every moment sacred, leaving no moment out, no matter how mundane it seems or even how painful it is. So this is my work. I know we've gone a little bit long, but I'd like to end with one story about how our lives can embody the light of awakening from the depth of darkness, an example of embodying the ultimate in our actions. This is a story told by Jack Kornfield in his book, The Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness, and Peace. A 14-year-old boy had shot and killed an innocent teenager to prove himself to his gang. At the trial, the victim's mother sat impassively silent until the end, when the youth was convicted of the killing. After the verdict was announced, she stood up slowly and stared directly at him and stated, "I'm going to kill you." Then the youth was taken away to serve in the juvenile facility. The mother of the slain child went to visit his killer. He had been living on the streets before the killing, and she was the only visitor he'd had. For a time they talked, and when she left, she gave him some money for cigarettes. She started to visit him more regularly, bringing food and small gifts. Near the end of his sentence, she asked him what he would do when he got out. He was confused and very uncertain, so she offered to set him up with a job at a friend's company. Then she inquired about where he would live, and since he had no family to return to, she offered him temporary use of the spare room in her home. For 8 months, he lived there, ate her food, and worked at the job. Then one evening, she called him into the living room. She said, "Do you remember in the courtroom when I said I was going to kill you?" "I sure do," he replied. "Well, I did," she said. "I did not want the boy who could kill my son for no reason to remain alive on this earth. I wanted him to die. That's why I started to visit you and bring you things. That's why I got you the job and let you live here in my house. That's how I set about changing you. And that old boy, he's gone. So now I want to ask you, since my son is gone and that killer is gone, if you'll stay here. I've got room and I'd like to adopt you if you let me." She became the mother of her son's killer, the mother he never had. This is love in action. Love that transforms at the base, the ultimate dimension shining through our mundane, miraculous lives.